resignation of Stephen E. Murphy Jr.
I'll call the Senate State Affairs Committee to order. There's President Senator Taylor, Senator Miller, and myself, the Chairman, Senator Lehman. First order of business today will be the confirmation hearing for Colonel Sig Murphy. Colonel Murphy, if you'd join us at the table, we'd like to hear from you, and as we, just so you know what we typically do, I don't know if you've been through this before, but...
I haven't.
Okay, well, we're not too brutal, but if you could give us an opening statement perhaps about your qualifications, your background, and then we'll open up to the committee for questions, and I just want to note for the benefit of those in the audience, maybe several know that you've been, suggested for elevation to the rank of Brigadier General in the National Guard by Major General Bucox, and that requires legislative confirmation. So go ahead, and if you'd make a statement, three minutes or whatever you'd like.
Okay, Chairman Lehman, Senators, I believe you may have a bio on some involvement I have with the National Guard. Let me fill that in if I could. My wife Mary and I had helped start Brother Francis Shelter and Clare House and a number of other organizations in the Anchorage area, and I came up with some ideas of how I could expand that statewide. Talked to the then Adjutant General, who was Major General Nick DeCrassen, and he suggested the programs were viable and invited me to join the Alaska Army National Guard. Quite frankly, I looked at it as an extension of what I was already doing. At that time, before the total force concept came into being, the National Guard in Alaska had one primary goal, which was to protect the lives and property of our fellow Alaskan citizens. We trained for that, we were manned for that, and we were equipped for that. And because of the support of General DeCrassen, I was able to go out to almost all the communities. We developed a pre-legal system, will, powers, attorney, and things of that nature. We developed programs for incentives for education, especially in the bush communities. And now, as you're probably aware, Major General Cox, Adjutant General, is developing programs specifically going to affect the summer to help with such things as drug reduction through education in the villages and throughout all the different communities that the National Guard serves. To make a long story short, if I can skip over a number of years, I was originally the Staff Judge Advocate for a number of years. In fact, I was the only attorney for the Army National Guard. Handle all their affairs, represented the state, the Adjutant General, sometimes the governor. And then a few years ago, I was put in a command position. My command position was the Deputy State Area Command Commander. The State Area Commander was General Tom Carroll, who perished last November. I worked with General Carroll for a number of years. I'm familiar with all the programs. I traveled with him around the state, traveled with him to Washington, D.C. for meetings at the Pentagon. And I've developed an expertise both with interfacing with the federal or active components, we call it, and people around the state. My duties as Assistant Adjutant General will be as follows. First, I advise the Adjutant General with regard to such matters as interfacing with the active Army. I would travel to the Pentagon on occasion, but mainly my duties would be to help them with the youth programs that we have around the state, to help them with change of commands, ceremonial things, and things of that nature. I will not be here lobbying in any way. I hope that answers some questions that you may have. Do you have any other questions?
Any questions from the committee? Senator Taylor?
I know that you've been a district court judge in Anchorage and are. How long?
Yes, sir. With permission of the chair. Senator, I've been a district court judge for a little bit less than 1 year.
How do you find it?
Well, I love it. I have a lot of calls from old colleagues. I was an attorney for 20 years, and I wanted, again, to do something that would help the community, and they were hurting in the district court. In fact, we still are. We need at least one more judge. We have 92% of all the criminal and 87% of all the civil matters in the Anchorage area in the district court. So it's busy. I thoroughly enjoy it.
That's one of the bench. I used to sit on the same bench for about 6 years, and they frequently would ship me from Wrangell up to Anchorage, and I would serve for 4 to 6 weeks at a time there up in Palmer.
In fact, I served at Palmer last week.
Very much. And, yep. Your credit,
that's
wonderful to have you on board.
Thank you. Appreciate it. Mr. Chairman, any other questions?
Any further questions? You might, Judge Murphy, you might comment on, it's kind of a little bit different from your confirmation, but on the response of the Guard to the terrible loss of life and how going about, I mean, you can never replace those who have lost, but, you know, in terms of the function and how the Guard is responding to that, and because, you know, we lost some extremely talented men who were vital to the function in Alaska, and just maybe how you're responding to that.
Well, I'm personally involved. I was at General Carroll's house for dinner the night before. In fact, he invited me to travel down here with him, and I had a jury deliberating, and that's the one reason I wasn't on the aircraft. But it was a terrible blow to the Guard. We had our top officers on the aircraft. We had our top NCO in the Army Guard. And not only were they all excellent soldiers, they were the key to what General Cox has been doing, which is modernizing both theoretically and in the field the components that we have. Quite frankly, with all the cutbacks at the active component, as saying, we learned last year that there's going to be cutbacks in the Guard too. General Cox, along with General Carroll, were working on a program to improve the training and improve the equipment that our Guard has in state. As you probably know, there's a number of pragmatic views looking at the Guard. One view is that we bring in over $100 million of federal funds a year at a very limited cost to state. I think the ratio is between 16 to 1 to 20 to 1. And this means not only jobs and money for people throughout all the communities that the Guard serves, but it also means that we're able to train our youth in jobs and help them raise families. And we give them a little dignity, we help them with education, we send them to schools all over the United States. And quite frankly, General Carroll was an instrumental part in working with General Cox on that. I was, the day after the action, I was appointed the acting assistant adjutant general. I'm not here trying to fill the shoes of my friend, General Carroll, but I know all the programs he's working on because he assigned a number of them to me to develop. And so I'll be able to carry on the way he was carrying on. We have, General Cox took his time to fill the other positions because, as I said, there were the top positions. I was on the board that assisted in selecting individuals for that. We did it in a very open fashion, even opening it up to the active component. And we came up with a excellent individual who is active duty, and he's coming over to the Alaska Army National Guard, Colonel Byington, who will be the Stark commander. And I think that that's a real, that's great for the state. He has a perfect interface with the active component. He knows the general officers and others that he'll be dealing with in Washington, and he is an excellent trainer and has already provided a great insight. He was the active duty advisor for the Guard in the last year or so, and he's a good soldier. And we filled the other positions too. It was hard for us, but I think we're through the grieving period and we have to move on.
Thank you. That's a note that we've been joined by Senator Ellis. Senator Ellis, this is Judge Murphy, perhaps you've met previously. Is there anybody, are there any further questions from the committee? Anybody in the audience who wishes to comment on the confirmation hearing for Judge Murphy? Thank you for joining us, and if you care to sit through the rest of the hearing on the next bill, you're welcome to.
I'd like to.
You don't have to.
Thank you, Chairman Lehman and Senator.
Thanks for coming down and joining us. It's a pleasure for us to be able to meet with you in person.
Okay. Thank you.
Our next item of business is Senate Bill 33. We'll read the title. It's one of these bills with the title as long as the bill. But it's dealing with the State Emergency Response Commission and local emergency planning commissions. We have providing the case to walk through on the bill, representing the sponsor. It's the bill that I sponsored, Annette Kreitzer. Ms. Kreitzer, if you'd like to go ahead and walk us through the sponsor statement and get us started.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And members of the committee, for the record, my name is Annette Kreitzer, and I am staff to Senator Lauren Lehman, sponsor of this bill. Initially, Senate Bill 33 was introduced as a mechanism to alleviate problems that DEC was having in being able to fund the LAPCs for their functions, and also to allow DMVA the ability to use federal HMTUSA funds toward the LAPCs as well. Sometime in February, the commissioners decided, commissioners of DMVA and DEC decided that it would be beneficial to move some of the duties of DMVA into DEC and some of DEC's duties into DMVA, and they asked the sponsor of this legislation, Senate Bill 33, if he would consider adding that to this piece of legislation. And so what you see today is a committee substitute, which would enable those things to happen. And there are representatives from DMVA and DEC here who can speak to the specifics of the bill and explain why these changes would be beneficial.
Thank you. Do we have any questions or discussions? Thank you. Next, we have Kurt Fredrickson from DEC. Mr. Fredrickson, just, are we on teleconference yet, James?
Yeah.
Okay. For those listening in, what sites do we have?
Anchorage, Fairbanks, and Skagway.
We have Anchorage, Fairbanks, and Skagway online teleconference. This is the State Affairs Committee, and we have present at the committee Senator Ellis, Senator Taylor, Senator Miller, and myself, the chairman, Senator Lehman. And we've just heard from representative of the prime sponsor, Mr. Annette Kreitzer. And next we have Kurt Fredrickson from the DEC, who will present the position of the Department of Environmental Conservation. Mr. Fredrickson.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee.
Push your switch forward.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Kurt Fredrickson. I'm with the Division of Spill Prevention and Response in the Department of Environmental Conservation. We support the amendments before you to SB 33. The department believes this would be helpful in implementing a decision made by the State Emergency Response Commission in 1991 to address issues regarding the hazards faced by local communities in the state, not only by oil and hazardous substances, which fall under the purview of the department, but natural hazards as well. This bill would do that by transferring, if you will, the administration of the State Emergency Response Commission from DEC to the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs. The bill also does two other things that are important to the department. Beyond transferring the State Emergency Response Commission to the broader goals of an all-hazards emergency response planning under DMVA, it distinguishes the responsibilities of the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs to provide planning assistance to local communities to address all these hazards that local communities face in addition to oil and hazardous substances. And it also defines better, we believe, the department's role in oil and hazardous substance spill response. It does that in two ways in the bill. One, it transfers the response depot and cores that currently is housed in the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs to the Department of Environmental Conservation, as well as makes it clear that the Hazardous Substance Spill Technology Review Council would also be reporting to the Department of Environmental Conservation with respect to spill oil and hazardous substance spill technologies that are important tools in the response to spills under the purview of the department. Basically, those are the three elements that we find helpful in the bill and which we've worked with the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs as well as local emergency planning committees. And we support the bill and would welcome any questions from the committee.
Do we have any questions, Mr. Fredrickson? Senator Taylor?
Mr. Fredrickson, did you prepare to stand up?
I don't believe so. I'm not sure.
It says John Sandor on the bottom of it and Hugh Cox.
I did not prepare that. I believe that. I'm not familiar with the document. That may have been a document agreed to earlier by both commissioners in initiating this legislation.
Is there anybody here who could speak to the development of this document?
Yes, I did.
We're going to be hearing from Mr. Morrison in a little bit, so at that time we can hold it. Any questions, Mr. President? Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
We have next, Herb Martin from DMVA.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name, for the record, is Irv Martin. I'm the director for the Division of Emergency Services in the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs. The joint position paper, Jeff Morrison and I work with Commissioner Cox and Commissioner Sandor and over a lengthy period of time, and that was the impetus for developing a cooperative relationship on changing some of the responsibilities. The Department of Military and Veterans Affairs strongly supports this proposed legislation for a number of reasons. The Division of Emergency Services has a working relationship with local governments in the preparation of disaster planning and training and preparedness for civil defense and natural disasters. and it was logical and more cost-effective to also consolidate the technological hazards because of the existing training relationship with local governments and our agency. In any disaster, the same principles of management and the same functions apply, and we were instrumental in the creation of the initial 11 local emergency planning committees, and the majority of the disaster mini cabinet chaired by General Cox is in fact reflected on the State Emergency Response Commission. The reason we got the depots and the cores was the Oil Spill Commission concluded that we had a capability for communications and logistics during a disaster, and that's how the statutes were created that gave us the depots and the cores, when in fact, if I could draw a parallel for you, the Division of Emergency Services does not fight wildland fires. The Division of Forestry and DNR does. They maintain their own equipment caches. They have their own responder units. And we feel that the Department of Environmental Conservation should also increase their capability by taking possession of those resources, which would make them much more responsive should the need arise. And I'd be happy to answer any questions that you may have in relationship to this.
We have questions from the committee, Mr. Martin. Senator Taylor?
Yeah, I guess I'm just trying to work my way through this this memorandum that you guys worked up. And on the bottom of what would be page 2, the middle of page 2, we've got the fourth paragraph down, the last sentence, it says, the need to have state-operated and maintained emergency response depots in all areas of the state is no longer valid.
Yes, sir, that's correct. Subsequent to the Exxon Valdez oil spill, the industry has committed something in excess of $110, $120 million in equipment, material, and response capabilities. With the declining revenues and the reduced operating budgets, we feel that the state cannot afford to compete in those areas where, in fact, there is a response capability established either through the nonprofit co-ops or what is already out there. What we need to identify are those vulnerable areas that have a threat that have no response capability. The depots and cores have had something in the neighborhood of $2 million or less in appropriations. And for us to compete with what industry has already developed out there, over $100 million would take us an exceedingly number of years to try to establish that. So what we need to do is to cooperate with what is already out there in those regions where it's established, and then for those areas that are threatened with a significant hazard is to go out and create some sort of response capability where there is none.
I guess I'm confused. Response capability to what?
To oil spills, Mr. Chairman. Marine
oil spills in areas that are somehow not covered by the industry capacity today?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. I can give you some examples. In Prince William Sound, Alyeska has something in excess of $50 million in equipment, material, and personnel. On the North Slope, Alaska Clean Seas has something in excess of $40 million. In Cook Inlet Spill Prevention and Response has something in excess of $30, $40 million. Skimmers, boom, train responders, contracts with fishermen. Southeast Alaska, we have no capability, but there's a great deal of transshipment that goes by Southeast. Dutch Harbor in Alaska. Alaska Clean Seas had a equipment depot at one time, and I think they've reduced it, but there's a great deal of refined petroleum products which transship Dutch Harbor in Alaska.
Thank you.
And we think there may be, in fact, be a need out there, and we're also looking in the area of Kodiak.
Do we have further questions from the committee?
Well, but it would seem to me that
Senator Taylor?
It would seem to me that in light of this comment, the legislature should seriously consider whether or not we continue to maintain a 470 fund or tax people for it, if in fact there's no longer a need. If all we're really concerned about is refined products and the transshipment of refined products, that takes an entirely different response, I would think, than crude. Especially, I mean, we're not looking at tankers, we're looking at barges coming up the southeast that have gasoline and diesel and
Mr. Chairman, if I could clarify, there is a need for both crude oil and for the refined products, and it depends upon the type of equipment, the boom material, and the skimmers that you have. But there is no capability in Southeast Alaska, and it needs to be created. There needs to be a response capability. Once they get beyond Alyeska and Prince William Sound's boundaries, there is still justifiable need for creating a response capability.
Further questions for Ms. Martin? I just note that we've been joined by Senator Duncan. Senator Miller?
I do have a question, but first we should probably adopt the CS that we're working on that document. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I would move Senate Bill 33, State Affairs, and move the original bill.
The committee substitute for Senate Bill 33, State Affairs, working document. Are there any objections? Okay, we have before us committee substitute for Senate Bill 33. Any further questions, Mr. Chairman?
Yes, I do have one. So far we've been talking about response on the seas. What about land response? I mean, I got a pipeline that grows right by me. What should we have a major rupture in the pipeline? What kind of response do we have in Fairbanks?
Mr. Chairman, last year the legislature appropriated some money and some legislative language for the creation of regional hazmat teams. The interior communities are faced with a different problem than marine coastal communities because of the types of equipment that you would use either in harbors or on the high seas or, you know, in the waterways. We are working with Fairbanks, Anchorage, and the Kenai Peninsula Borough in the creation of those hazmat teams, not only in the training, the organization, but also the acquisition of some equipment and material to make them viable responders on land-based spills. And I'm not sure, but I think House Finance Committee eliminated that funding this year in the closeout. But we were on track for the creation of regional hazmat teams in the interior.
Mr. Ellis?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Some of the materials here in the folder refer to Fairbanks having submitted a response plan and it not being approved. Do you know any of the details of that? It sort of ties in with Senator Miller's comment or question.
Mr. Chairman, I would defer to DEC because they provide primary staff support to the committees for the Emergency Response Commission. Prior to 1990, the Division of Emergency Services was a prime player in the creation of the LAPCs. We did training and orientation at the local government level for the first 11 LAPCs that were created. We gave them a cookbook, fill-in-the-blank uniformity that met state and federal law requirements. And we worked with Fairbanks in the creation of their plan, but I cannot answer the question of why it has not come to pass.
Further questions? Thank you, Mr. Martin. We have next testifying from the Department of Law, Lee Sensen. And I just, before you get started, we are going next to, following Ms. Sansone, to the teleconference network, and we will take first testimony from Skagway, and following Skagway, we will go to Anchorage. I don't have the name of the testifier in Skagway, but I believe there's one, if you can be ready to testify. And then in Anchorage, Jim Seeberger, Ken Reicher, and Bob Van Hook, in that order. Ms. Sansone.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Marie Sansone. I'm an Assistant Attorney General, and I have worked with the State Emergency Response Commission and the local emergency planning committees for a little over a year. I have not had a chance to review this draft of the bill. I could answer questions related to the commission or the LEPCs, but as to this bill, I probably have to take it back and review it.
Okay, that would be fine. Do we have questions on the Sansone related to LEPCs or anything?
I really don't have a question for Ms. Sansone, but I note in the backup materials, we're talking about departmental position, a January 26, 93 memorandum to Janice Adair from Michael Conway, the director, most of which depends totally upon whether or not you received the March 19, 1992 memo, because questions that I might ask Ms. Sansome are, what impact, if any, will we have, what federal sanctions, if any, would we face if we do not have a CERC or LEPCs?
I can probably answer that, Mr. Chairman.
Well, I'm told in here all I have to do is look at this memo, but it's not in the packet.
The date was March 19th. I can provide a copy of that memorandum.
Oh, I'm sorry, I've got it here.
It's in the packet.
It's down underneath it. Maybe you can just tell the committee what's saying.
Yes. Mr. Chairman, in 1986, the Congress passed a law called the Emergency Planning and Community Right to Know Act. It's also called SARA Title III, and that is the law that requires the state, the governor, to appoint a state emergency response commission, and then requires that commission in turn to establish planning districts and appoint the emergency planning committees. There are no sanctions against the state by the federal government if the state does not comply with this act. However, the statute does allow for citizen suits for failures to comply with certain parts of it, and it allows for injured persons to bring tort claims against the state or against these local emergency planning committees if they fail to act or act in a negligent manner. But unlike, say, the Clean Air Act, which has the highways funds provision as a hammer, this the Emergency Planning Community Right to Know Act does not have any federal hammers against the state.
Any further questions from the committee? Thank you for joining us. And if you can stay, that would be fine. If not, we're going to move into the public testimony part. Thanks. I was just notified that Skagway will not have a person to testify, so we're going first to Anchorage, Jim Seeberger. And I also note that the others that I listed had signed up to observe only, so Mr. Seeberger, I believe you're the only one from Anchorage. Go ahead with your testimony.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. As Chairman of the Anchorage Local Route 690 Committee, some changes to Senate Bill 83 for consideration. And the things that we've heard this morning, they all point to the need for individual regional planning. We have to have local input to create these plans. And for that reason, on page 2 of the bill, recommend that word 7, strike the word and, after the phrase 7 public members.
Good. Mr. Seeberger, can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Do you have a copy of committee substitute for Senate Bill 33 before you?
No, I don't believe that I do.
Okay, that is what we are working from right now, and I don't know if the rest of your testimony is dealing with the committee substitute or with the original bill, but if you can get a copy of the committee substitute from the LIO, we will come back to you, and perhaps you can make your testimony correlate with the committee substitute. Would that be possible?
It would be fine. I will get a copy of it.
Thank you very much. We will go next to Fairbanks to Mr. Robert Spencer. And following Mr. Spencer, we will come back to Juneau for Jeff Morrison and Larry Fanning.
Hello, this is Bob Spencer. Can you hear me?
We can hear you very well.
Yeah, I'm
coordinator for the Fairbanks LEPC, and I'm here to testify about a couple of things that relate to this bill and to the substitute. First, I'd like to report that the Local Emergency Planning Committee Association met on March 15 to discuss this bill. Over 30 people participated, including representatives from DEC, ADES, Senator Lehman's office, the Attorney General's office, and DCRA. I hope I'm not leaving anyone else out, but also the, I believe, 13 or so representative LEPCs from around the state. And overall, we had pretty good, strong feelings of support for the concepts of this bill. Probably the biggest objection to the overall thing was more political than anything. That was the fact that most of the people, or the people most closely related to a good portion of the bill, and those sections are primarily related to LEPCs and community right to know, were not consulted in the writing of it. This meeting we had in March was immediately after January CERC meeting, where such consultation had been promised and assured. Now before me, I have this draft, and I do notice that a couple of the recommendations of that LEPC Association meeting have been implemented. However, a couple of the other items had not been. One of those was a really major objection by the whole committee. That has to do on your substitute, page 6, line 9, having to do with the appointment of a chair who, it says, shall be an elected official of the municipality represented on the committee. And just prior to that, it says that a local elected official, at least one, shall be on there. And we all felt that this really limits the choice that the LEPC has and who will be chair. Chances are it's going to be one elected official even willing to participate, and therefore he or she will automatically become the chair. Our experience here in Fairbanks has been real marginal with the elected officials who have been on our committee. Not saying that they're not good people, but they have a lot of other issues in the fire, and their attendance has been spotty at best. Quite often their expertise along the lines of community right to know, hazardous materials, or anything else has been real marginal. I think it's a real problem mandating that elected official be absolutely the chair of the committee. Not saying that if the committee doesn't wish that to be, that shouldn't happen, but I think there are a lot better choices in the community. Title III wanted these LEPCs to be a citizen committee, and by putting a political official in charge of it, you're eliminating that factor of it being a citizen committee. That was the strongest objection. There were a couple other more suggestions than objections that were recommended. Under the section having to do with who reviews, annually reviews the state master plan, it's on page 11 of the substitute. LEPCs are somewhat conspicuously left off of the review list. It does say municipalities and so forth, but it doesn't say LEPCs, who are supposed to be these planning committees for the local area. And the only other addition C is still lacking that was recommended by this committee is having to do with where the response cores are going to be developed. This is on page 14 of the substitute. And the recommendation out of the committee was that the response cores be developed at the local level. And so responses are going to start from the local level and work upwards through the state and feds, depending on how big the situation happens to be. But it has to be the local people that are the ones that are involved in the development of those cores. That pretty much is my testimony of today.
Thank you, Mr. Spencer. We have questions from the committee? We have no questions, but Mr. Spencer, I just will comment on your first comment. It certainly wasn't my intent that we require that the chairman be an elected official, and that's something we're working on. We have this agreement with the DEC on that one, and we'll be working on that as we work through the bill. Thank you for your testimony. In Juneau, Jeff Morrison.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Jeff Morrison, Legislative Liaison for Military and Veterans Affairs. I want to speak very briefly to the position paper that was just handed out to you. This is something that the ink is essentially still fresh on Commissioner Sanders' signature, and that's why I was delayed in getting here this morning. He's been tied up working on responses to budgets, as is Assistant Commissioner Dare. The position paper is organized in such a way that it gives you some background, highlights problems with the current organization, and then summarizes how the bill addresses those problems. And all those things have pretty much been already introduced through previous speakers. I also worked with Janice Adair in the development of the fiscal notes, which I believe probably should be part of your package. The fiscal notes are based on the current governor's submission, which is my understanding of how the fiscal note should be prepared. So if there's any changes that have taken place in either the House or the Senate, the fiscal notes would not necessarily be consistent with the latest versions of those budgets and could possibly need to be amended depending on the what happens in the budget process. But I'm prepared to answer any questions on either the fiscal note or the I may have to defer questions on some of the programmatic aspects of the position paper, but essentially I drafted it based on input from others.
Questions, Mr. Morrison? Thank you for joining us.
I'm just confused, I guess. Can you, in a thumbnail way or in a summary fashion for the benefit of the committee, explain what we really are transferring from and to and for what purpose?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. The Department of Environmental Conservation is currently the cognizant state agency for the State Emergency Response Commission, or the CERC. And the LEPCs are appointed by the CERC and basically work with the CERC to prepare local plans. That's in DEC right now. This bill would take that and move it into DMVA. The main benefit to be derived from that is that DMVA already currently works with local governments for preparing disaster plans for all other disasters other than the ones that the CERC is specifically appointed to do. So by having both the CERC, in with the DMVA, we can adopt an all-hazards approach and have the CERC work with the LEPCs to expand and to avoid duplication and confusion when local governments are charged under Title 26 with preparing emergency plans for all disasters, and then Title 46, they're required to work with LEPCs and prepare special plans for hazardous materials and oil spills. As Irv Martin pointed out earlier, a lot of the effort that goes into preparing plans for responses to emergencies is really the same. And it just, you fine-tune it depending on the nature of the response, but the resources that you have are the same. You just use the resources differently depending on what the type of the disaster is. And so this is, you know, we hope that this will avoid confusion and at the local government level and just generate efficiencies in that respect. So that's the CERC and the LEPC's move from DEC to DMVA. And then DMVA currently is statutorily the state cognizant agency for oil spill response depots and cores, and then that would be relocated to DEC. That's the basic switch that's going on here.
Senator Taylor?
The mayor changing, though, from the agency who has oversight and mission responsibility for accomplishing these tasks, that does not change the requirements of the federal law as concerns the makeup of the various LEPCs or LEPDs, does it?
Mr. Chairman, that's correct. The federal law still is in place. I think I'm not familiar with the federal requirements on who should be on the LEPCs, but it's my belief that the latest CS that you have in front of you would meet the requirements of the federal law. It does by requiring the local governments to participate on the LEPCs, which I don't believe was a requirement in previous state law. That's intended to by that measure, accomplish the coordination with local government that has been lacking with LEPCs.
Good for the questions, Ms. Morrison.
Well, I guess my concern was that it says here on that March 19 memo, in answer to the question, do we have any limit on the number of members of an LEPC? And it says yes, that there are 13 categories of members that are required by law. The next question, number 14, was, what if a local fire department was all a community could get to do this? The answer was, then the community would not have an LEPC. Both federal and state statutes stipulate that a broad representation of the community must be represented on an LEPC. So unless we can find 13 different members that fit this federal category, the community can't even comply and have an LEPC.
Mr. Chairman, I'm not familiar enough with that law. I think Mary Samsung possibly could be a better...
Marie's nodding her head back there. So.
Yes, I can...
Ms. Samsung, Jeff, you can stay here with us. And Ms. Samsung, just make sure you flip your mic forward. We have some people listening.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Taylor, the federal statute is set up with the 13 different categories. The punctuation in the statute creates some ambiguity because you can lump certain of those members in the way that is drafted into this bill and come up with only possibility of only having a 5-member LEPC. Now, there are LEPCs that have more than 13 members and wish to have larger committees because they have multiple industries or maybe multiple government functions that they feel warrant additional representation on the LEPC. But to comply with the federal law, we would need to assure this membership. And on the CS, it's on page 5 and 6, lines 29 on page 5. This is a way that the federal statute would allow this grouping. I guess one peculiarity to notice is on page 6, where in line 3, the owners and operators of facilities subject to the requirements of the federal law, those are the owners and operators of facilities that have on their premises the extremely hazardous substances, the substances that are lethal on short-term exposure. Our state law goes beyond the federal law and also covers hazardous substances, substances which may be hazardous but not necessarily lethal, or lethal in a short-term time frame.
Thank you, Ms. Samsung.
I guess that's part of my concern, Mr. Chairman. I mean, I really think that the people who need to be responding to these concerns in a community and responding to hazardous spills or the potential for those hazardous spills are people that have some level of training, know something about what they're doing, know where their equipment is and how they're going to react if, in fact, something like this occurs. That certainly does not include an elected state or local official. It does not include every single or a person necessarily off law enforcement, civil defense, firefighting, first aid, health and local, I love this one, and local environmental group, hospital, transportation personnel. Then just to make doubly sure we're really covered, we're going to have somebody out of the local FM station that has to be there or out of the local newspaper. Unless you've checked your newspaper lately, they wander these halls and they can't even figure out what happened after it's happened around here. At least I don't believe they do when I read what they write. And then it's just a general group of some community. It would probably be nice to have the Ladies Quilting Society be part of it or something. I think this is a farce. It's a complete waste of money for us to be ginning up a whole group of people in every single community to sit around and wring their hands and come up with what? A plan that's going to be 15 inches thick on how to do this in case this happens and how to do that in case that happens and when in fact it actually happens. In the middle of the night with a 40-mile wind blowing it, guess what? You better have your local volunteer fire department and rescue squad alerted to what's going on, and they better know where to go get the equipment they need. And they certainly shouldn't have to call up somebody out of the local media to get their permission and find out where the plan is, and if, in fact, the local busybody group has finally come up with a plan. I don't mind having something practical that's going to work. But we're 4 years past the Exxon Valdez oil spill, and most of these things aren't in place, and the two agencies that are responsible for it are now saying, oh, I want to throw the hot potato back over here because we haven't been able to do it. Somebody else wants to throw it back this direction because we couldn't find enough people in enough communities. You haven't even built your first lousy warehouse to put any booming in, bought one skimmer. When this is the agency that's been finding real good ways to use up all the money, I'm not impressed at this point. And you better be able to come up with a better explanation as far as I'm concerned on this thing, or I'm going to ask for the bill and kill it personally myself.
Do you have any questions of the witnesses?
I think that deserves a response. I think he ought to be given an opportunity to respond to it. I'm not the only one that has a microphone around here.
Mr. Chairman, actually, I think I'd prefer if Irv.
I just want to note that we're going to be going back to Anchorage for Mr. Seeberger's testimony, and we're going to have to end at 10 o'clock. We have 7 minutes, and I don't want to belabor that point. That's probably something that could take considerable time to respond to.
I think in 25 words or less, the main point of having the LAPCs is to establish priorities and community concerns that would be assisted by the professional staff. That would be provided through the fiscal notes of this bill. And the staff would work with the first responders to train and prepare the first responders to make sure that the first responders were ready to respond in accordance with the priorities that were set by the LAPCs. I think that's in a nutshell, the purpose of having the broad community representation on the LAPCs.
Thank you, Mr. Morrison. We're going back to Anchorage. Ms. Seeberger, have you had a chance to look over the committee substitute? Are you prepared to testify on it?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. I just got a copy of the latest CS. I certainly haven't had a chance to go through it. My feelings are going to be, I'll just address my comments to what I saw in the older draft. I was also concerned about the chairman of the LAPC being directed to be a local elected official. He's certainly welcome local official input, where we felt that it would be a tying our hands to make a local elected official serve as the chairman. We have many members of these committees, and I feel that we would lose our autonomy if we were required to make one specific category of personnel fill that position.
Do you have any further testimony, Mr. Seeberger?
I have one other comment I wanted to make. On the CERC, the makeup of the CERC, I would like to see that we have both a rural and urban LAPC required membership there. And there was another committee that had addressed the original draft. I would like to see that also include a representative of both a urban and a rural LAPC to ensure that we have the input from the local communities on these groups. And with that, I will conclude my testimony. I apologize for some of it. I am unprepared for it, but I had just worked on a different draft.
Thank you, Mr. Seeberger. I just note for you and for others listening that our plan is not to move this bill today. In fact, we're planning to hold it during interim and to do further work on it and possibly have other hearings. I'd sure appreciate it if you would provide your comments in writing to the committee. We appreciate them, and we will take that as we work the bill over.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I have Larry Fanning in Juneau.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, Senators. I think I'm on. My name is Larry Fanning. I'm the fire chief in the city and borough of Juneau. I represent the Lassa State Firefighters and Fire Chiefs Association, and I'm also on the local emergency planning committee. for the Juneau area. Several of the issues that I wanted to testify have already been addressed this morning, one of them being the elected official chairing the committee. As you know, you're all busy, and so are they. And sometimes we need to get work done while they're working on other committees. The other issue that I would like to address has to do with the fiscal note, in that the LEPCs are agents of the state. The fiscal note shows a decrease in funding of $800,000+. The LEPCs need money to operate as a committee of the state. I don't know, it looks like maybe $100,000 in the fiscal note will go to contracts, we'll go back to the LEPCs for operations. Without the funding, the LEPCs will die. And according to federal law, the CERC is responsible to the state for the establishment of the LEPCs, so it could fall back on the state's shoulders for the management of the LEPCs within the state without that funding. So I think it's important to note that fact. From the fire chief's point of view, I think they endorse this this document, and we look forward to further review during the interim period of time.
Okay, thank you for your testimony. Do you have questions, Mr. Tenney?
Thank you.
Senator Taylor?
You can tell I'm concerned about these committees and how they're actually functioning. You're sitting on one.
Yes, sir.
How in the world are all of these varied people supposed to know inherently, I guess, in their minds, because they were selected to be there because of their background, how are they supposed to know how to respond or what to do when they come from these 13 different things, so that they can give, as I was told, guidance and training guides to your people? I assume your people would be among the first responders, that and maybe Coast Guard or search and rescue or somebody here in town.
To the chair and Mr. Taylor, yes, sir. If you look at a news broadcasting person, that person has the ability to develop the PSAs that would go inside of the plant. If you look at the firefighter, he may have the technical knowledge to identify what resources are going to be necessary and what areas of evacuation would be required for a spill. Having a police officer on the committee, he can talk about how he's going to secure, what the resources would be necessary to secure a particular area. If you look at a nursing physician or a physician from the hospital, they can talk about the concerns that they may have about a contaminated patient coming into the hospital and what may be necessary to do to mitigate that particular aspect. So when you look at finally developing the plan, you'll have a strategy laid out with tactics on what needs to be done. It'll be the summation of the whole. To me, the ideal plan has got a checklist for the first 24 hours, the first initial actions that need to be done. Secure the area, identify what the problem is, and then look at mitigation problems or mitigation aspects of it. And inside the plan should be the resource identification of what's necessary to do it and where to go to get it to be able to boom or to dike or to decontaminate, to spray water or whatever is necessary. So when you get the summation of the whole of all these different aspects that goes into this plan, and the plan will be structured, where there will be in the PSAs, that the local elected official needs to say, we're going to evacuate the downtown district in Juneau. It'll be all printed out inside of there. It's going to be just handed to that mayor or that city manager and say, this is what you need to do, instead of having the mayor have to sit out and write what needs to be done at that point in time.
Thank you. I appreciate it. That was very fine. That was a very fine explanation. I really appreciate that. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Senator. And Mr. Chair, if I may have one more comment.
Go ahead.
And that's the concern of the depots and the planning. And this is from the LEPC, local LEPC aspect, not necessarily the fire chief speaking, but we have a planning operation going over here, and we have a depot operation going over here. I'm kind of concerned about the communication that happens between the two of them. That maybe the depots and the planners should be in the same agency, because the planners are going to say, how many of this you're going to need? And then how's that going to get over to the depots to be stationed and say, that's what you got to have, or that's what we have? So it's, if we have looking at planning throughout the state of Alaska, saying we're going to have these depots, and then we have these other people who are going to be responsible for these depots, the communication between the two and say whether they have the materials or not.
Thank you, Ms. Fanning, for the questions. Thank you for your testimony. Is there anybody else in the teleconference network who wants to testify on Senate Bill 33 who has not had an opportunity to do so? Is there anybody in Juneau who wants to testify on Senate Bill 33? If not, we will close testimony on Senate Bill 33 for today. So I announced our next meeting will be Friday at 9 o'clock. We will be holding over Senate Bill 161 that was on today's calendar, and we will be taking that up on Friday, as well as bills previously heard. Any other further business come before the committee? If not, we will be adjourned at 2 minutes after 10.